Chapter 83. Princess of Wales, my God, then, I will bow to. She rises and bends to him. Prince Regent, she thinks we rose on her account. A damn fool. Aside. Emperor of Russia, what didn't we? I certainly rose in homage to her. Prince Regent, no, sire. We were supposed to rise to the repeated applause of the people. Emperor of Russia, H'M. Your customs, sir, are a little puzzling. Dot dot, to the King of Prussia. A fine-looking woman. I must call upon the Princess of Wales tomorrow. King of Prussia, I shall, at any rate, send her my respects by my chamberlain. Prince Regent, stepping back to Lord Liverpool. By God, Liverpool, we must do something to stop them. They don't know what a laughing stock they'll make of me if they go to her. Tell them they had better not. Liverpool, I can hardly tell them now, sir, while we are celebrating the peace and Wellington's victories. Prince Regent, oh, damn the peace, and damn the war, and damn Boney, and damn Wellington's victories. The question is, how am I to get over this infernal woman? Well, well, I must write, or send Tyrwhitt tomorrow morning, begging them to abandon the idea of visiting her for politic reasons. The opera proceeds to the end, and is followed by a hymn and chorus laudatory to peace. Next, a new ballet by Monsieur Vestris, in which M. Rosier and Madame Angiolini dance a pas de deux. Then the sovereigns leave the theater amid more applause. The pit and gallery now call for the Princess of Wales unmistakably. She stand up, and is warmly acclaimed, returning three stately curtsies. A voice, shall we burn down Carlton House, my dear, and him in it? Princess of Wales, no, my good folks. Be quiet. Go home to your beds, and let me do the same. After some difficulty she gets out of the house. The people thin away. As the candle snuffers extinguish the lights, a shouting is heard without. Voices of crowd, long life to the Princess of Wales. Three cheers for a woman wronged. The opera house becomes lost in darkness. Act 5, Scene I, Elba. The quay, Porto Ferrajo, night descends upon a beautiful blue cove, enclosed on three sides by mountains. The port lies towards the western, right-hand, horn of the concave, behind it being the buildings of the town. Their long white walls and rows of windows rise tier above tier on the steep incline at the back, and are intersected by narrow alleys and flights of steps that lead up to forts on the summit. Upon a rock between two of these forts stands the Palace of the Mulini, Napoleon's residence in Ferrajo. Its windows command the whole town and the port. Chorus of ironic spirits, aerial music, the Congress of Vienna sits, and war becomes a war of wits, where every power purpens with all its dues as large, its friends as small, till priests of peace prepare once more to fight as they have fought before. In Paris there is discontent. Medals are wrought that represent one now unnamed. Men whisper, he who once has been, again will be. Dumb show, under cover of the dusk there assembles in the bay a small flotilla comprising a brig called L'Inconstant, and several lesser vessels. Spirit of rumor, the guardian on behalf of the Allies absents himself from Elba. Slow surmise too vague to pen, too actual to ignore, have strained him hour by hour, and more. He takes the sea to Florence, to declare his doubts to Austria's ministrator there. Spirit ironic, when he returns, Napoleon will be where? Boats put off from these ships to the quay, where are now discovered to have silently gathered a body of grenadiers of the old guard. The faces of Drouet and Cambron are revealed by the occasional flick of a lantern, to be in command of them. They are quietly taken aboard the brig, and a number of men of different arms to the other vessels. Chorus of rumors, aerial music. Napoleon is going, and naught will prevent him. He snatches the moment occasion has lent him. And what is he going for, worn with war's labors? To reconquer Europe with 700 sabers. About 8 o'clock we observe that the windows of the Palace of the Mulini are lighted and open, and that two women sit at them. the Emperor's mother and the Princess Pauline. They wave adieu to someone below, and in a short time a little open low-wheeled carriage, drawn by the Princess Pauline's two ponies, descends from the house to the port. The crowd exclaims, "The Emperor!" Napoleon appears in his gray greatcoat, and is much fatter than when he left France. Bertrand sits beside him. He quickly alights, and enters the waiting boat. It is a tense moment. As the boat rows off, the sailors sing the Marseillaise, and the gathered inhabitants join in. When the boat reaches the brig, its sailors join in also, and shout "Arrest or death!" Yet the singing has a melancholy cadence. A gun fires as a signal of departure. The night is warm, and balmy for the season. Not a breeze is there to stir a sail, and the ships are motionless. Chorus of rumors, haste is salvation, and still he stays waiting. The calm plays the tyrant, his venture belating. Should the corvette return with the anxious Scotch colonel, escape would be frustrate, retention eternal. 4 aching hours are spent thus. Napoleon remains silent on the deck, looking at the town lights, whose reflections bore like augers into the water of the bay. The sails hang flaccidly. Then a feeble breeze, then a strong south wind, begins to belly the sails, and the vessels move. Chorus of rumors, "The south wind, the south wind, the south wind will save him, embaying the frigate whose speed would enslave him, restoring the empire that fortune once gave him." The moon rises and the ships silently disappear over the horizon as it mounts higher into the sky. Scene 2, Vienna. The Imperial Palace, the fore part of the scene, is the interior of a dimly lit gallery with an openwork screen or grill on one side of it that commands a bird's eye view of the grand saloon below. At present the screen is curtained. Sounds of music and applause in the saloon ascend into the gallery, and an irradiation from the same quarter shines up through chinks in the curtains of the grill. Enter the gallery Marie-Louise and the Countess of Brignole, followed by the Count Nieberg, a handsome man of 42 with a bandage over one eye. "Countess of Brignole, listen, your majesty. You gather all as well as if you moved amid them there, and are advantaged with free scope to flit the moment the scene palls." Marie-Louise, "Ah, my dear friend, to put it so is flower sweet of you, but a fallen empress, doomed to furtive peeps at scenes her open presence would unhinge, reads not much interest in them. Yet, in truth, 'twas gracious of my father to arrange this glimpse hole for my curiosity. But I must write a letter ere I look. You can amuse yourself with watching them. Count, bring me pen and paper. I am told Madame de Montesquieu has been distressed by some alarm. I write to ask its shape." Nieberg spreads writing materials on a table, and Marie-Louise sits. While she writes, he stays near her. Madame de Brignole goes to the screen and parts the curtains. The light of a thousand candles blazes up into her eyes from below. The great hall is decorated in white and silver, enriched by evergreens and flowers. At the end a stage is arranged, and tableau vivants are in progress thereon, representing the history of the House of Austria, in which figure the most charming women of the court. There are present as spectators nearly all the notables who have assembled for the Congress, including the Emperor of Austria himself, his gay wife, who quite eclipses him, the Emperor Alexander, the King of Prussia still in the mourning he has never abandoned since the death of Queen Lusa, the King of Bavaria and his son, Metternich, Talleyrand, Wellington, Nesselrode, Hardenberg, and minor princes, ministers, and officials of all nations. "Countess of Brignole," suddenly from the grill, "something has happened, so it seems, madam. The tableau gains no heat from them, and all turn murmuring together." "Marie-Louise, what may be?" She rises with languid curiosity, and Count Nieberg adroitly takes her hand, and leads her forward. All three look down through the grill. "Nieberg, some strange news, certainly, your majesty, is being discussed. I'll run down and inquire." Marie-Louise, playfully, "Gutenberg edition. End of chapter."